sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Earnings season flops. Oil prices surge by 8%. The Greek drama is in full swing, and our guest today is Peter Pham, author and international fund manager. All this and much more on Super Bowl weekend on The Disciplined Investor, episode number 398. Well, hello and welcome. Andrew Horowitz here, and it is the Super Bowl weekend, Super Bowl Sunday here. We got the Pats and the Seahawks lined up for battle. And it's interesting that to note that there is a... is actually a Super Bowl indicator when it comes to markets. It's always something when it comes to the markets. You look at Groundhog Day, you know, you look at the January effect, you look at the January indicator, look at the Santa Claus rally. Well, there is the Super Bowl indicator. And if you don't know what that is, it says, by history at least is what it says. I take this with a grain of salt, by the way. If the AFC wins, well, that's going to be pretty negative for the markets. If the NFC wins, well, that's going to be really good. So right now, the favorite in the Super Bowl, as of Sunday afternoon, is leaning a little bit towards the Patriots by about 1.5 points. That's about what they have on their side. And if they win, they're in the AFC, well, they're going to show that, well, the markets aren't going to do so well from moving forward. Seahawks, on the other hand, on the NFC, well, that's who I'm putting my money on, quote-unquote. At least I'm putting my hopes on Seahawks. I seem to like them a little bit better. And if they win, well, they're going to have a good market outcome, at least for the foreseeable future, at least till next Super Bowl. So it says. We'll see how that plays out. There's a lot more going on besides that, obviously. But, you know, when it comes to superstition, there's a lot of things that are really very well thought about by investors. And some of these indicators put into their mindset, the psychology of investors, all these things add up. So when we see that the January indicator, which says that it foretells what the year will be, what January goes, so goes the market. And January was a down month for the markets in the U.S. by about 3.5% on the S&P and NASDAQ. It looked like there was going to be a little bit of a savior, a stick save at the end of the month, where we saw that there was a nice reversal on Thursday from about down 0.5% to about up 1%. Dow finished up very nicely that day on Thursday of last week. Up over 1%, about 250 so points, and then just took it all back on Friday. And a lot of this has to do with what's going on with earnings season. Economics, we saw that the GDP disappointed, still growing, but disappointed on Friday as well. And we are seeing on Thursday, and we saw that there was a variety of other indicators. And over the weekend, we did see that China is continuing to slow down, now in officially in a contraction territory for their manufacturing index. And that came in sub 50 at 49.5, I believe it was. And that's below, and that is going with the trend that China is seeing a significant slowdown right now, along with the rest of the world. We also saw more deflationary pressures hitting in Europe, even though interest rates are historically low. We're seeing that the Greek situation is really causing problems. There has been a massive, massive flight of money out of the Greek banks. You know, with the opposition party winning the election last week, the hopes of any kind of easy solution here is dampened significantly. Even though France is saying, hey, yeah, we'll do some concessions, and we see that Italy and Spain are perking up. They're like, hey, wait a minute. If Greece is going to get concessions, what about us? Germany's pissed. Germany's absolutely pissed. They don't want to hear anything about this. They're going to lose all sorts of money if there's a write-down or any kind of default on Greece. And then again, if in fact there are any kind of concessions given, whether it's an extension of time to repay the almost $50 billion in debt that now is available and been lent to Greece, or if there's going to be a drop in their interest rate, or if there's going to be a write-down or anything in between, I am certain that you're going to see at least, if not more countries, but Spain and Portugal and Italy start to get really nervous and say, wait a minute, if this is going to happen, why should we be going along with this austerity program And why should we actually be paying these interest rates? And we want to go the route of what Greece is doing to free up the opportunity to get more money. Now, the main problem here is that this is going to be very painful on the banking system and cause a lot of money to be drawn from Europe. Now, this could weigh on the euro. On the other hand, the idea that Greece coming out of the euro, if they come out of the eurozone by their own desire or being thrown out, well, that could be actually positive for the euro. We saw the euro stabilize a bit last week, and that had to do with some of the pricing pressures put on it by weaker than expected economic data and earnings data in the U.S. Not all companies. Obviously, Apple did well. Netflix did better than expected. Microsoft flopped very, very hard. I think that was one of the worst days I ever saw for Microsoft, down about 10% on their earnings number that came out. But we did see 75 million Apple iPhones sold during the quarter. 75 million. Tremendous number that came out there. So all is not bad, but remember something, that without Apple, we even see a much worse situation for earnings on the S&P 500. As a matter of fact, the energy component, which is pulling it down dramatically, about 20% drop in earnings growth on energy companies due to the fact that we saw oil slip so dramatically, is showing that over this quarter and the next quarter and the next quarter after that, for the next couple of quarters, we're going to see a slowdown in earnings and sales. That's the estimates. The actual is coming in lower. As a matter of fact, the lowest earnings growth we've seen since about 2009 right now. And it looks like we're going to see a negative earnings growth in the next two quarters by all estimates. And don't forget, analysts are usually pretty positive. They're pretty bullish. And we're seeing that they have earnings estimates moving lower in the negative region. That's a big concern overall. That's also a deflationary number because we're seeing that sales are slowing down. So the idea of inflation in the U.S., I think, is pretty much shot to hell. The thought that we're going to see any kind of major pickup, and if in fact the dollar keeps on growing, that's a real negative for the inflation environment in the U.S. So the Fed has a lot of work to do. They came out with their statement last week and said, hey, we're not really thinking about really changing anything that we've put in force at this point. If things do change dramatically, of course, they will adjust their moves. But right now we did see surprise moves by Canada, Singapore. We saw that negative rates in Denmark. A lot of things are happening around the world trying to devalue currencies and trying to move their markets and increase the value of risk assets with the hope that that will increase inflation, and that doesn't seem to be happening. While earnings are better in the U.S., they are starting to slow down also in the rest of the world. So maybe what's happening here is that some of the contagion factors that everybody thought we were exempt from are really going to come home to roost. Now, oil did see a massive move on Friday. I don't know if you looked at this, but starting at about noon or so, oil started creeping higher and then moved up by about 8%. Now, why is that? It takes a lot to move oil that kind of level in an intraday without any significant news, and there was no news to speak of. Could have been the close of options, end of month. Could have been maybe this whole situation that's brewing down in Texas, that there's a strike that is going on with the oil workers. Maybe it was the fact that a variety of oil companies are shutting down rigs. And if you remember something, I mentioned that commodity companies have the ability to expand or contract their productivity. And as they do that, what happens is that their productivity, in terms of whether it's bringing up oil, mining for gold, slows down, they also bring up the supply-demand curve. So what happens is the supply lessens, demand stays the same, and therefore there is a squeeze on the overall net supply-demand, therefore bringing prices up. So they can artificially, for a time, slow down production, yes, hurt their earnings and hurt their overall sales, but at the same time potentially bring prices up to an equilibrium level where they're in better shape. That's what's happening. We see that in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, they're in Iran, they're not reducing down their oil production. So right now, it's up to the U.S. to really do something dramatic in order to create that artificial supply drop. We saw that 13 million barrels of oil were added to inventories last week. That was tremendous. So we know that the Middle East and Saudis and all the countries there are, even in Latin America, are trying to squeeze U.S. producers, break the back of the frackers and the shale drillers, etc. That's a big issue. So mind the price of oil right now. If you do see the price of oil continue to hold, I would venture to say it would be a pretty hard thing to do considering how much selling has been going on. But if it does hold here, I really do, and I've mentioned this before, I do like a lot of the players within the oil industry, because any kind of incremental move in oil at this point will really benefit them. Now, what we did was we bought options on the XLE. This is the ETF of the oil services index of the S&P. And we bought options, call options, out to February. We may roll them to March, as a matter of fact. Those are up tremendously, 50, 60% on Friday with this move. And we've been adding to that position as it's been coming in a bit. And it's doing very nicely. And that's a good sign, because if the oil does move and the earnings do come back, that could be a very good benefit to the overall S&P earnings. We'll see how that plays out, but that may be some of the reason why analysts have been cutting estimates moving over the next couple of quarters. Now, a couple of things I want to mention to you before we get to our guest. There is an Aero Strategy update. I want to mention something interesting about the Aero Strategy that I thought was really fascinating when I looked at it again just the other day, in terms of the long-term performance when we do the backtesting and review of what's happened over time. There's been three instances where the Aero Strategy has underperformed significantly the buy and hold S&P. And those years were 1999, 2007, 2014. 1999, 2007, 2014. Now, what do all those have in common? I looked 1 year after that and noticed that each of those times were the times when the markets really sold off significantly. Obviously, we know what happened in the 1999-2000, where we saw the tech bubble, big pop there, all sorts of problems. Markets rolled over the next couple of years. 2007, obviously, with the financial situation. And 2014, we're not quite sure yet, but we're starting off pretty negatively on 2014 in terms of the S&P 500 and the indices in the U.S. And I just wonder if there's any kind of interesting correlation there. We won't know this for a while, but there's an interesting correlation to seeing that there was an unusual circumstance in those years, over the last 15 years, that caused the Aero Strategy to misfire. And if we see that the following year is a real negative, now, each of those times the following year, the Aero Strategy did extremely well against the S&P, positive on both the accounts in 2000 and 2008. But I do wonder about that. Anyway, interesting. We have a new update coming out on this. If you want to take a look, you can either email me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com, or you can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and click on the Aero Strategy to the right there, or in the show notes from this episode, and check it out and find out more about it. Very in-depth detail of performance history, backtesting, review, update on the algorithm, understanding of what it's all about. And this is a strategy that we run for clients for you. And again, it's long, short, or out. So very interesting strategy. Well, let's get to our guest, Peter Pham. And I want to talk to him because this, I was on his show not too long ago, and we had a very interesting conversation. I thought I'd ask him back. Also, just to let you know that this coming Tuesday, TradeStation, I will be teaching a technical analysis strategy discussion on Tuesday at 11 o'clock. Go over to TradeStation and just look up stocks and ETFs update. You can register and watch it live at 11 a.m. Eastern. I'll also be on Frank Curzio's great podcast coming up this week, so listen in on that. Of course, DH Unplugged. So lots of things and lots of places to find me this week. Out there in the podcasting and the audio world. Anyway, let's get right down to it. And our guest today is Peter Pham, and he's an author, international fund manager, and registered financial director by the Cayman Islands Monetary Authority. In 2013, he published his first book entitled The Big Trade, Simple Strategies for Maximum Market Returns. And he currently manages the portfolio of a global hedge fund and runs an asset management company called Phoenix Capital. We'll have all this on the show notes. In 2010, he founded AlphaVN.com, a popular online trading resource focused on capital markets and trading in Southeast Asia. And in 2014, he launched the Big Trade series, a podcast. And actually, I was on that, about 3 weeks ago, Pete, right?
Yep. It was a great one.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good. I had a good time. So let's talk about some of the things going on. I know that right now you're in Vietnam, one of my favorite countries in the world. So that's great. And I wanted to talk about some of the market issues that are going on right now. What you're seeing in Asia, there's been a change in the dynamic. Listen, in China, over the last, 6 months, the A-shares and the H-shares, they're just going gangbusters. One of the reasons is that all of a sudden the Chinese got excited. When the Chinese get excited about something, it could be big. But what they did was they started doing tremendous amounts of margin buying, right? I mean, the leverage amount in China right now is more than it's ever been. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, I think that that issue, I actually just met up with Jim Rogers and we kind of talked about this as well. I think there seems to be some kind of connection between what's happening in the commodity space and how and why Chinese equities are going gangbusters. I get a sense that because the Chinese now are playing a much larger role in terms of commodities, their futures exchanges actually make up a bulk of the volume for many of the major commodities that are traded throughout the world right now. For example, like iron ore, soybeans, they've clearly surpassed Chicago, New York, and London in terms of volume. And one can speculate that because the PBOC is playing such a major role in bringing in deflationary pressure for these commodities, they've then taken a look again at what could be done in terms of policies that can stimulate Chinese equities. And one of the key factors that are leading to this is the internationalization of their capital markets and their equities especially. And I think that that's a major byproduct that is led by the stimulus of the PBOC, in addition to retail investors clamoring again to some of these equities. So if you take a look at how the Chinese equities have performed, they reached an all-time high in 2009, I believe, and are only recently starting to make some gains, which is very different from the story that you see in the developed world in which you see equities at all-time highs.
Yeah, what's interesting is that they came out with, I think it was 16 months before the stimulus that we created, they came out with stimulus. They were getting hammered a bit before. They're in kind of a 1.5 year cycle to the left of where we are. And what's interesting is, you know, we noticed from the, you know, from time and time again, we've watched, okay, well, the emerging, remember when the whole, wow, the emerging market story, you know, that big story that was out there back in, we'll call it in the 2000s, early 2000s, maybe in the late 90s. And what we saw was that that did happen. One of the things was that, of course, the amount of people, the industrialization, manufacturing, infrastructure development, and just the overall modernization of these areas throughout Southeast Asia, Latin America, some of the Middle East, et cetera, some parts of Europe. This was a big theme for a long time. As a matter of fact, the theme, as you mentioned, Jim Rogers, he was on that for a while. Although these days he's kind of more onto the farming and agricultural thing, isn't he?
Big time, right? Yeah, like I just spoke to him last week, actually, last Friday, and he indicated to me that no, he's very much still into some of these ideas. He definitely represents a lot of conviction to these ideas. I asked him again about North Korea, which he is bullish on. I asked him again about Myanmar, which is what he's bullish on. And obviously the bellwether of all of this is China. We discussed about things like the significance of rule of law and how that plays a role. I'm very big on those aspects. I think that they are proponents of helping markets, whereas he would then argue that, those aspects are losing value in the developed markets, like in America, for example, and they are gradually loosening up on China. So it seems to be a battle of ideas, and you know, BRICS are going to be a benefactor if you believe in these factors. Immediately, once we completed our conversation, he immediately said to me that he's going to go out and buy Russia and renminbi.
Wow.
So that was, yes.
Wow. Russia and the renminbi or the ruble? The ruble or the renminbi?
The renminbi.
Wow,
and Russian equities.
Wow. That's a guy with some balls. what do you say? A guy that rides a motorcycle and wears a bow tie. You can't. You don't want to cross a guy like that.
No, you don't. Those are the most dangerous kinds of people. Right?
If he had a handlebar mustache, that's it. To stay the hell away. So let's talk about a couple different things. One of the things that I know you've talked about before is, and something you're pretty passionate about, is the fallacies of technical analysis. Now, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the other side of this, because one of the things that I do is in our overall, in our analysis, I think I told you about this. We do the quantitative and the fundamental and the technical, kind of put them all together. But you have a belief that technical analysis is archaic. Now, when you say archaic, is that like, it's something that was used in the past, it's not really good to use, or something that's always been ridiculous to use?
I think that a traditional technical analysis is archaic. And what I mean by that are, for people that are using, say, for example, you download any of the latest charting software, and you're using anything like, you know, stochastics, MACDs, moving averages, I believe that, and through experience, I have seen that they don't tend to often work the way that you'd like to work, Andrew. And I believe that once you just take a look at the numbers and the statistics, it takes away the ambiguous nature of that kind of analysis. Now, what I discuss about in my book is actually about two psychological phenomenons, which are reification, which is the seeing of patterns, and multi-stability, which is coming to conclusions based on the patterns that you're seeing. So another form of traditional technical analysis is seeing, for example, like head and shoulders, cup and handles, all of those patterns, which can be actually left up to interpretation. Now, all I strive to do or communicate to people is that we should be a little bit more rational. We have computers this day and age. We have Excel spreadsheets, and the ability to derive probabilities and statistics based on certain behaviors in price will give you a much more larger competitive edge. That gives you, and it also takes away that whole ambiguous nature. In the scientific method, they discuss about the ability to replicate studies and come to the same conclusion. So when someone is looking and analyzing price data, for example, if you're on your desk, Andrew, and I'm on my desk, we should be able to use the same kind of tools and come up with the same kind of conclusions. Now, if we were to look at charts and we were to look at price patterns, for example, looking at the pictures of the graphs and changing different time frames, it becomes very ambiguous. So what I like about what you discussed about when you were on my show was the merging of, I think, almost like three major schools of thought. And what I strive to do, and I communicate that quite passionately about in my book, is actually being able to use a set of statistics just to define your probabilities. And this is becoming a very popular school of thought. It's called big data analysis to some extent. I think that that would be important. There's a lot of people that talk about algorithmic trading, which is the use of statistics and computers running a whole bunch of quant strategies to be able to find an edge in the market. So all I encourage people to do is, besides just looking at pictures and patterns, to be able to find the statistics, make sure that it is follow some kind of approach to the scientific method, just to improve your probabilities in you know, highlighting great trading and investing opportunities. A simple approach, what I mean by that is maybe not using the squiggly lines that people use using indicators, and maybe going with a simple straight line anywhere on a price graph and understanding the behavior of price as it moves above and below a particular line that you draw on the chart. And I think that already provides you with some kind of quantitative edge.
Well, let me just back up for a second, because we could talk about this. When you say squiggly lines, let's use, I'm assuming you use something like a moving average, which obviously you can use a simple moving average. You can use an exponential. You can use a volume weight. There's all sorts of ways to use a moving average. But let's just use the very basic, well-known 50-day moving average, which is a simple moving average of the 50 days of price, and it's moving. So it constantly is taking off the last one and bringing the new one. Doesn't weight it, just continues on a 50-day pattern. Now, one of the things that's interesting is that I have a very good friend who's well-versed, well-schooled, and he puts out charts on a regular basis. And what he does is he retrofits the moving average for the particular index. So, for example, let's go back, let's just say, as an example, a two-year period of time. And we see that for whatever reason, he comes up with a 125-day moving average. Each time the S&P 500 hits that 125-day moving average, it seems to be a special bounce for whatever reason that is. Now, mm-hmm. I always ask him, like, wait a minute, who's using a 125-day moving average? Or is it something more that's involved there? You know, is it something that is a, it just happens to work out that you see each time it comes down to the 125-day moving average or breaks through a little bit, it you know, turns around and moves up? I mean, what is the significance? I really don't understand how retrofitting a number like that. I mean, if you come up with a 172-day moving average, wow, look at that. It always bounces off of there. Now, there is some probabilities there because if you see that five or six times it does do that, why question it at a point, right? But one of the problems I have is I get how the 200-day, the 100-day, the 20-day, the 50-day are used by professional traders, institutions, particularly the 200 and the 50 and the 100 to a degree, as the line that they say is, hey, this is the smoothing mechanism. This is the average. This is what we look at in the line of sand. Because what happens is when it breaks through there, it's not that they may have so much conviction in that particular line, but everybody else is doing the same thing, thereby creating the actual move. You follow what I'm saying?
Yep.
So one of the things I like to use, and one of the things I think is different than what you are talking about with these squiggly lines and all that, is looking for where the institutions are actually purchasing, where the individuals are drawing the line in the sand, utilizing things like maybe a trend, maybe an indicator of some sort, but more so volume at price. Is that something that is something that you look at? You look at market auction theory. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. I was going to suggest that. I mean, if you really like, you know, aside from taking something like the 200-day moving average, if you want to get more precise on where people are buying, it's all about, you know, having a three-dimensional look at those volume bars and understanding where the bid and ask activity is happening and you know, the magnitude and abnormal magnitude that is happening at. That suddenly, once again, goes by numbers that can be quantifiable and can clearly show you the difference between buyers and sellers and how overzealous they are in terms of buying. So remember, it's all guesswork, right? You're assuming people are using the 200-day. You can say anecdotally that, you know, Joe over there at, you know, RBC's trading desk is using it, but that's too presumptuous to make,
yeah,
right?
Very presumptuous. Exactly. That's a good point, yeah.
So what we want to do is we just want to look at the numbers. And I think that if you want to focus on that magnitude of momentum, you're probably going to want to break it down to numbers again and look at market chain auction theory by just analyzing the breakdown. And there's a lot of software service platforms that provide you that information. There's some people that discuss about how they can look at market depth and how that gives them some insight. So it's basically when bids and offers are being hit or lifted that provides you that information. And yes, that at the end of the day, this is a market and at its purest form, it's impacted by buying and selling. And people say that, but how many people are able to implement that information? Maybe there's a very small percentage of people that truly understand those mechanics to some extent. So, you know, I think it's a good service for us to be discussing about this to the audience for them to be able to recognize that, no, there's more to it. Any guy that's probably working at the NYSE that's controlling trade and flow, you know, being a market maker can easily explain to you why equities are going up and down. And why should a retail trader sitting and listening to this not be able to understand that, hey, I can use some of this information to really understand price momentum?
Yeah,
but I mean, to top that off.
Yeah, okay. Continue.
Sure. But to top that off, I also need to, it would be valuable for me to understand that there's a 80% probability that whatever equity that I'm looking at that has open high and low and close will either surpass its, you know, previous day's high or low, at least 80% of the time. So when you merge those two ideas of understanding, you know, what's happening between buyers and sellers, and if you're recognizing that there's more buyers than sellers, and then you see the equity that you're analyzing surpass its previous day's high, like or approach its previous day's high, there's a high probability based on the statistics of the back testing that you've done on price, and then a high probability based on the lifting of offers that you're going to see the price go up. That's really what it boils down to.
Right. Well, there's also the idea that there's shorts and longs in the world. You know, one of the things that I think is funny is reminds me of, I had a conversation with somebody and they said, oh, I wish I could just take all the short sellers out and just shoot them, you know, when markets are going down. I said, let me explain something to you. Your best friend as a long only player is the short sellers.
Yep.
Because once things are getting to a point that everybody's selling out and there's, you know, continue selling going on, who's going to be the incremental buyer when things get really bad, when things turn? You know, people usually have the instinct that, you know what, I'm going to continue selling out of fear, out of concern, out of worry. And greed doesn't kick in until things get towards the top. Who's going to be the incremental buyer when things turn? It's going to be the short seller that's covering their shares. That's what usually starts a rally. And yeah. And I tried to explain this to this person. They just couldn't understand what I was saying because it just seems so foreign to them. I said, yes, short sellers can bring stocks down. No question about that. But I got to tell you something. If you've ever seen a short squeeze in action and you're long on that stock, it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful thing.
And on a much more macro perspective, Andrew, I think first and foremost, like to your friend, we would want to say to them that number one is that markets work and you need to allow them to work. And you can definitely ask the Swiss National Bank question because they've spent the last several years trying to intervene, trying to peg basically the Swiss franc against the euro. And basically, if your friend's been following the news, you would have heard that the Swiss National Bank, Thomas Jordan, has come out and said that, you know, we recognize that this policy just doesn't work for us, period. And he's allowed the franc to basically act as if without intervention. And this is the byproduct of that, as now the franc has become effectively a hedge against the euro's monetary policy. So,
and by the way, I don't understand. I mean, all those companies that got just ham-boned due to the fact of their overall participation in shorting the franc against the euro or shorting the franc against the dollar, I'm still a little bewildered who was doing that and why they were doing that. I don't really necessarily, maybe you could tell me, because I don't understand what the logic was when you had the euro itself to play with. You know, yeah. if it was pegged, if the theory was it was pegged, then the peg was never coming off, in theory. I know there's some arbitrage you could do there and all that, but generally speaking, why really push a lot on that where if you think the euro is going to come down, use the euro as your piece anyway?
Yeah, I think, believe it or not, there were just people that really believed in the intervention policy, and for whatever reason were caught on that trade. There were tons of hedge funds that got hit by this that just blew up overnight. It wasn't just that. It was all the Forex brokers that got hit. The scary question is how did they get bailout so quickly as soon as they announced their capital ratios were at certain levels? And then, boom, suddenly there were bailouts that happened almost immediately for companies like FXCM.
Well, I'll tell you why FXCM got a bailout, because Leucadia came in and said, here's $300 million. Dollars. Okay.
Yeah.
And it's going to be starting, I think, at 15% interest rate, and I think it goes up 1% per month until they pay it off.
Yeah.
And I don't know about you, that's pretty good.
It is pretty good, and it's also very scary. I think one of the new themes that I would like to be known to be passionate about is the fact that the 1% is playing such a big role in capital markets. You know, I talk to many people about, like, if they really want to get into investing, number one is they got to do it sooner rather than later. Number two is they got to understand the difference of what Warren Buffett did compared to what everyone else is doing, and understand what's happening in the global market environment. You and I had a conversation about this on my show about how effectively the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. And what seems to happen is, and this is connected to the whole FXCM story, is that what I'm noticing, Andrew, which is profits and profitability is becoming privatized, and basically risk is becoming socialized, right? And it's going up the echelon beyond just a sovereign nation like America into like multi-country situations where it's like the Americas, Europe, and Asia. And what is very concerning is post 2008, once you had the credit crisis, the oligarchs, technocrats, and plutocrats all worked together in conjunction with each other, ended things like Glass-Steagall Act, right? Merged banks through roll-ups and mergers and acquisitions. That's why you have like Bank of America Merrill Lynch, which would be illegal to have executed, only a few years ago. But post 2008, this is what you've seen. And the scary part is after that all happened, then you start to see more regulation around the world, which scares me because the 1% have basically effectively built all these amazing oligarchical multinational companies with, you know, 1,650 billionaires around the world. The question is, what is the average Joe or the person that's listening going to be able to do now? And what's concerning to me, Andrew, is that I feel as if probably the minority groups are underrepresented in financial services, and financial services is the lifeblood to the economy. So what we need to do is, number one, is we got to get into equity markets. We need to see what guys like Warren Buffett have managed to develop and achieve, see what's possible before the regulatory environment becomes that much more difficult. And I think that's the bigger crisis that's actually happening right now in the world. And, you know, when you take a look at that whole meeting that they had in Davos, you'll recognize that guys like Warren Buffett last year, his net worth is up like 9%. Bloomberg's net worth is up like 22%. Icon's up like 23%. I don't know about you or me, but my net worth was not increased that much. So I think that being investors, we got to recognize what we can do in terms of using capital markets to the fullest of our advantage before it becomes too much, before it becomes too late, I believe. And everyone in the US that I talk to complains basically about the regulatory environment. So what's scary is, how can you create these entities that these guys have built, like the Icons, like Bloomberg, basically even providing like financial terminals, and like Buffett have, and be able to go the path and trajectory they did?
Because a lot of the wealth is created by a must-have kind of product now, or something where there is, listen, Buffett initially created a lot of his wealth through insurance and financial services types of companies, right? Now, he bought, what was the number one thing he bought in the beginning? It was insurance companies.
Yep.
Talk about a way to profit on, I mean, we know insurance companies have a pretty good profit program going on, because what they do is that they're utilizing all sorts of actuarial numbers on a lot of unknowns. This is for life insurance. And they have it's the ultimate, I say this with a bit of a tongue-in-cheek, but it's a bit of the ultimate Ponzi scheme.
Right.
You know.
But here's the question, Andrew, is that can you and I at this day and age do something like that if we do not have all that access to investment banks? And the answer is, especially if you're an underrepresented minority group without the relationships on Wall Street, the answer is no.
No, of course.
Exactly. So we need to think about, as a collective, basically, that, you know, if you're recognizing all these trends, what can be done before it becomes too late? Because I generally believe that the regulatory environment is going to be like a scorched earth strategy, in which it's just, now that everyone's been able to roll up and consolidate, all the, you know, the 1% have been able to do so, the average Joe won't be able to even reach or dream of seeing these opportunities that existed previously, which would then create a larger bifurcation between the wealthy and the poor. So that is a very important reason on why you need to be a pragmatic investor in this environment.
Well, I'll give you an example of something, which I'm not a big fan of this, but one of the things is, if you want to get in on lending, which obviously is usually a very profitable thing, we know about the banks, is something called like the Lending Club. Lending Club is a new stock that came out. It took about 5 years to amass about $200 million worth of loans. Now they're seeing a lot of competition. Let's put that aside for a second. This is just an example. I don't like this. I don't like the stock. I don't like the idea that there's a lot of competition. I don't like the fact they only have $200 million and all the other things that can happen if an economy turns and if these things go awry. But nonetheless, the Lending Club, it's basically a peer-to-peer or C2C type of consumer-to-consumer type of lending program where you can go in and you can actually lend money either directly to an individual who's looking for, I don't know, $250, $1,000, whatever it is, $10,000, $100,000. I got actually approved for a $300,000 loan. It just came in the mail. I didn't apply for it. It just came for my business.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. It was like 7%. I'm like, well, what? That's great, but that's so above the level of what you can get. But this is, they're taking on riskier loans, maybe not subprime, but they're taking on, we're not risky, but they're taking on, in theory, people that need money and charging them more. And this is a way that the individual can get in on some of the big play action in a way. I don't know what else is out there. What else, you know, you talk about this and you make it sound like, oh yeah, that's something I want to do, but how do you do that?
Well, exactly. I mean, you just mentioned it. The interest rate that you're paying is abnormally much higher than the actual, you know, current interest rate in the U.S. So it very much goes by tiers, right? And I think that we all, believe it or not, need to strive to be able to get as close as possible to these central banks as possible. And the issue is, one of my concerns is that it's going to become even that much more difficult as the balance sheet of many of these central banks are, you know, very questionable. And many people believe that you could be looking at, you know, more multinational entities like the IMF playing a role as providing financing to these central banks, which are acting like hedge funds. So my conclusion to all of this, Andrew, and what I think you need to do is, number one is you need to be a participant in capital markets, and you need to utilize them to the fullest, not just in the secondary market. You need to take advantages of what's available in the private equity space, building businesses, using whatever is left of, you know, basically cheap money to some extent to create businesses that are generating value for people. Now, like I said, coming from a minority group, is that it becomes even that much more critical because, you know, in many societies previously, you've had patrons and you had family offices that have supported the growth of many of these minority groups. And that's how they were able to flourish. If you take a look back into history and you see basically the whole Italian Renaissance, they were financed by bankers, by patrons, right? They were called the Medici family that helped finance guys like Michelangelo, Leonardo, Raphael, all the famous guys, and all the scientists like Galileo. You would think, like, you know, the whole concept of struggling artists, they weren't doing this for free. They were being supported by patrons. Now, what happens when, you know, you have Wall Street, which is becoming that much more oligarchical with certain groups and a certain amount of, like, you know, there are certain cliques and they're a very small minority. How does that help represent the rest of the world in some shape or form? So when, if you are either a woman or basically non-Anglo-Saxon, you're highly probably unrepresented in the global financial markets. So you need to basically go out there and think about how you can be more integrated from into capital markets, using the whole spectrum to your advantage before the regulatory environment becomes that much more difficult. You've seen it through capital controls right now. So it's just something that's on my radar.
Okay, and, I got you. I'm with you. And obviously one of the ways that you can get in front of it on the very basic level is to have a participation, bring it all the way back here, participation in equity markets, in fixed income markets, on your own versus just kind of leaving it sitting out there. All that. I mean, it's very basic, not looking to, okay, where do I start a company? What government can I get money from? What can I, you know, yeah. Very basically you can own a part of the play. I mean,
yes.
Warren Buffett, that's what he did. He owned a part. Now he obviously had a lot more money and, you know, over time he could do a lot more controlling and changing and working with the system. But the point is, you know, you take a look at, you know, what's the system? What can I work with? And I mentioned Lending Club, whether you do it as a loan and you act as a lender, or if you, in fact, are a buyer of the stock. Or the fact is that if you can then also take the opportunity to either hire somebody or learn for yourself to utilize the equity markets, the commodity markets, the fixed income markets, et cetera, in one way or another to your advantage, that also gives you a leg up versus just sitting back and just letting it happen to you.
Bingo. I mean, that's why a lot of people have not had that kind of exposure, right? I think it's a very small percentage of Americans that actually participate in the stock market now, because a lot of people believe that it's risky, right? And it becomes even more so for people that are much younger, that have seen the dot-com crisis, the credit crisis, and the current market environment right now. So that's
But hold on a second. They do a lot and probably participate a lot very passively, in terms of their IRAs, in terms of their money that they also have in 401ks and things like that. But how much do they do on a level of buying and owning a company, looking for the company that can, you know, breaking it down even further, not just a swath of companies inside of a mutual fund, which nothing wrong with that. But, you know, how much are they doing it on their own? Do they understand? And again, no, you know, listen, if you're a fireman, if you're a doctor, if you're a lawyer, if you're a sales clerk, I don't care who you are, you don't need to learn all this from A to B to all the way to Z. You don't have to, you know, sit down. Because I get clients sometimes like, I really want to learn about this. I'm like, okay, well, that's great. I can appreciate that and I respect that. But how long have you been saying that to yourself? Well, right, for 10 years, right, I've been really trying to think, well, what's going to change now? Where do you have the time to do that? So I'm not trying to do a commercial for our services here, but that's the fact. All right, listen, we got to cut it short here. Listen, I'm going to put all the information on your book, on how to get in touch with you, on the disciplineinvestor.com, on the episode notes for this particular show notes for this episode. And hopefully we'll stay in touch. We're going to, I know, and we'll try to see, you know, how we can make this all happen. Also, you should listen to The Big Trade Series, a podcast consisting of a series of discussions with various financial thought leaders, which means that I am a thought leader.
Yes, you are.
I am apparently a thought leader.
Yes.
I'm a leader. I have an army of thoughts that come with me.
You're a disciplined thought
leader. Yes. Oh, that's a good point. Good point. Anyway, thanks, Peter Pham. Pretty much that wraps it up. But thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you. It was magic.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye. Well, we're going to keep it kind of short today because we have a lot to look forward to this evening. Hopefully you are. Maybe you're tailgating, maybe outside your house, maybe you're in Phoenix. I don't know. Anybody that's at the Super Bowl, I'd like to hear from you. Tell me how it was and what it was all about, how great it was. Probably the halftime act is going to be awfully exciting. And, of course, if you do want to get in touch with me at any time, it's askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I always enjoy hearing from you. Tell me about the podcast, what you think. And you know what? Ideas. We're going to have some updates on the Disciplined Investor, the website, and we'll be continuing to send out information on things on Twitter. Make sure right now, stop everything you're doing just for the moment and follow me on Twitter. It's my name, Andrew Horowitz. That's the actual full Twitter handle, Andrew Horowitz. And if you were hopefully following last week, I put out some tweets, for example, on Thursday that we're looking for a flush down and then a buying opportunity on Thursday that worked out perfectly. If you follow along, maybe you'll get some ideas. Now, we put out things here and there, not, you know, trading ideas absolutely every single time, but you follow me. I put out a great picture, actually. I thought it was an awesome shot. I was out late at night over the weekend doing some fishing, and the sunset was absolutely beautiful over Fort Lauderdale. You have to check that out. Anyway, thanks for joining me. Of course, if you want to know more about things like what we have available on TradeStation through TriggerCharts, you can go over to TradeStation. If you're not using TradeStation, you really should be. They're the number one in my book in terms of technical analysis, and we have about six or seven different indicators that will help you trade and make you profitable. And then, of course, the strategies we have here, the TDI Managed Growth Strategy. If you think that maybe it's time to start looking at hedging a portfolio and shorting and using options and really not just being a long-only trader, maybe it's time to look at the TDI Managed Growth Strategy. All that and more can be found over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Thanks for joining me. I really appreciate the time we spend together, and hopefully you do as well. Enjoy the Super Bowl. Enjoy your week. I'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented that should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.